Welcome to Educated Conjecture, an Ipsos podcast that combines what the public thinks with what the experts think. Each week, Ipsos's Mike College and Sean Simpson are joined by an informed guest to discuss a current or emerging issue. Delivery, drive-through, takeout, or cooking at home? Canadians' food and beverage choices are changing. In this episode, Asad Amin, Senior Vice President and lead of Ipsos's syndicated food and beverage group, joins Mike and Sean to talk about the impact of the pandemic, inflation, pent-up demand for a dining experience, and generational differences, which are all affecting what Canadians eat and drink and where. And now, on to the episode.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Educated Conjecture. Sean, my friend, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
You're not really well, though. You have laryngitis.
Well, I'm a little raspy. You know, six nights in Vegas will do that to you.
Yeah.
But all is well.
That was a short stand for you. Normally you do, what, 20 nights in Vegas before they kick you out?
Whatever Ipsos will sponsor, really. Yeah.
Well, as much as you may not be, I'm glad you're back. And I'm
That's
excited.
Nice of you to say.
We have an Ipsos guest today. So Asad Amin is going to join us. He's a senior vice president over in the marketing side of our business. But before we get to Asad, do you have an interesting stat or an interesting to you stat that you'd like to share?
Yeah, I do. I do. And I was just reflecting on this because this morning I was filling up my gas tank here in Kitchener where I live. It was 2.07 a liter. But of course, I made the stupid decision of buying it's a Mazda, but it has a turbo engine and it likes the high octane. So I think that was close to 250 a liter for my gas this morning. And nice. So I was reflecting on this stat that I saw in a recent poll that we did for Toyota that showed that 77% of Canadians say they're likely to take a road trip outside of their, you know, local region. 43% will travel by road outside their province, and 24% are planning an international road trip, presumably that's to the United States. And I'm just wondering, you know, I'll be curious to see how that reconciles with the sky high price of gasoline right now, whether or not people will end up staying close to home, or whether that pent up demand from the last 2 years will cause people to say, you know what, I'm doing it anyway.
Yeah, it's interesting. The world's changing so much that as we ask our questions, often, you know, they weren't asked when there was $2.50 a liter gas. So my vehicle is not fancy like yours, so it takes regular gas, but it is a beast of an SUV, so it is like $140 to fill up. So at the end of the day, the same thing. So my stat is one I thought was actually pretty interesting, mostly because I grew up on a farm. But it's some work we did, you did actually, Sean, on a public release on Canadian farmers. And 81% are optimistic about the year ahead. And there's a lot of reasons I think that, you know, we see in sort of the broader citizen sentiment that people are a little pessimistic, although it bounces up and down, pretty volatile. But when you think about farmers, right, I mean, they're facing pressures from climate change. They're facing pressures from technology. They're facing pressures from the price of gas. And yet 81% are pretty optimistic. And I think that's likely because, and farmers are saying, I know why, is they've largely been ahead of the curve on technology, climate change, and a whole range of things. So they're, you know, the farmers that, you know, we probably have, you know, us city dwellers and stereotypically in our heads aren't the farmers we have today who are using drones to check their crops and doing all kinds of things and very, very advanced. And I think that speaks well about where that industry is going. And I said that stat because Asad is going to talk to us. Welcome, Asad, about food. And I love the connection between farmers and food. You know what? The definition of farmers is someone who's asked to feed the world for just enough money to starve his family. So that was what my dad used to tell me. So Asad, farmers aside, how are you today?
I'm very well. Mike, Sean, thanks for having me here.
So Asad, you spend almost all of your time at Ipsos thinking about food. And I don't mean like when the cafeteria is open and those kind of things, but actually doing research on food.
I actually do both. Yes. 4 hours. I'm a huge foodie. So, I mean, I can talk about just what I like to eat the whole session.
Well, we'll definitely get to what you like to eat at some point, but maybe talk a little bit about broadly the kind of research you're doing and maybe a top two or three trends to kick us off that you think are really going to drive things going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So I look after the food and beverage syndicated products within the marketing division at Ipsos. And what we do is we track consumption behavior in Canada. We're in field every day of the year. We've been around for close to a decade. And we have products that focus on what everything Canadians eat and drink. And then we have something that focuses on food service as well. And then
so would your beverage numbers have spiked up last week when Sean went to Vegas?
They dropped in Canada.
We have an alcohol consumption tracker, which kind of crashed this week for some reason.
Okay, all right. I'm just trying to understand. It might be correlation, might be causal.
One of the benefits that we've seen, obviously, with all the changes in the last 2.5 years, is just how much behavior has changed because of the fact that we've been homebound. And, you know, that hasn't changed. You know, if it takes 21 days to build a habit, we've had a lot more time than that for that to be built. So for sure, the fact that the habits that we've built over that period while we've been at home, whether, you know, you're more accustomed to having breakfast in the morning or you're preparing dinner because you haven't been able to go out. And there's going to be a portion of the market that is still going to remain at home, like we all are just now. So that's definitely one factor. Another, I think, near term is obviously the concerns on inflation and what impact that might have on people wanting to spend more money on groceries and the type of things they buy versus going out. And in general, there's been a big change that have been developing for some time from generational shifts and the dynamics within our country in particular, based on older cohorts, what they're accustomed to eating and drinking versus younger, and just the level of diversity within that. So at a high level, I think those are key things to be mindful of.
I do want to talk very much about the pandemic and the impact that it had on dining out, et cetera, because I'm someone who loves dining out. But one of the things that I noticed, and this was even just a couple of years ago, as minimum wages in Ontario crept up and other provinces as well, you saw the price of, you know, like Big Mac meals and, you know, Wendy's, like a fast food, just burger, fries and soda go up. I don't know. Was that because of minimum wage? And is it having an impact on how often people are eating fast food? Because it just seems a lot more expensive now than it was even 5 or 6 years ago.
100%. So, you know, the food service sector, it feels very – it's romanticized, right? You want to go to be a chef, and, of course, Tony Bourdain changed all that. But it's a tough industry. You know, it's got one of the highest bankruptcy rates. Profit margins are minuscule. And then you're getting pushed on both sides. So the price increases have been driven from a number of factors, from, you know, a higher cost of ingredients, obviously, on that end. But people have been ordering, you know, higher average checks. So in our data, we know that check size has been creeping up. And, you know, there's more family occasions where people are consuming less solo. That's one factor. But it's also to mitigate the losses. Right. I mean, traffic necessarily hasn't gone up. And if you're looking at your quarter over quarter performance continuously in this market, something's got to give. Right. And when your margins get thinner, that's part of the factor that is driving it. So it's kind of both internal as well as an external demand.
I mean, it must be the check size must be by design, because foot traffic's been going down everywhere. Right. And where more people, even pre-pandemic, with big screen TVs and the truck, you know, more people living in suburbs, harder to travel or within cities. I think foot traffic's been going down in the cores of major cities where a lot of activity, so more or less people are going out. So was it by design that they sat down and said, you know, how do we grow the per check business?
Yeah, it's a bit of both. One is by design, the industry's had to mitigate a lot of the losses they've had and just to drive up overall dollars. And it's within reason. It depends which industry you're in and who the players are. The other is also organic. You know, there's occasions where dinner's been the biggest focus of the day because, you know, no one's going to grab a coffee in the morning on your morning commute anymore. And if they are, you know, it's like I'm making coffee at home, so I'm just going to grab a donut or a sandwich or a breakfast sandwich. And obviously the check for those are higher. Dinner's always been the highest average eater check. So the focus has been there as well. Delivery, I don't know if you guys know how big it is. It's never been that big. I mean, it sounds like it's huge. You're talking about Uber Eats, Skip the Dishes. It used to be 4% of the market. Now it's about 10%. Still really? Small. Yeah, still tiny.
So a lot of growth, but still not a dominant factor.
No, no. But it's certainly been one of the biggest areas of growth. But, you know, you got delivery fees on top of that. And all of those prices will...
But what about takeout? Like, has takeout increased as well?
Yeah, so... There has been a trend for a while where off-premise has been growing, right? It's just because of our habits, convenience. You got Netflix at home. It's like, I don't want to go out. And it was just a space for pizza primarily. And there's been growth on all off-premise channels. I mean, it was happening before the pandemic, and now it just shot up because you can dine in. So takeout accounts for like more than half of all traffic at food service right now. Drive-through also grew exponentially throughout because obviously, especially the initial stages, it was a safe haven. It was actually a family evening out or a day out because it was an excuse to get out of the house. But it's still predominant. And, you know, McDonald's, some of these bigger companies, they're investing heavily within drive-throughs as well. And then, of course, you got delivery and you got the growth rate there. So all of them have benefited. From the pandemic.
So on the one hand, as you noted, we've fallen into some patterns of stay at home. At the same time, it seems like we're having a little, this is the first time in 2 years. I mean, COVID's not over by any stretch of the imagination, but we certainly feel like we're on top of it enough that we can go out and celebrate and we can go out and do things. And there's a freedom in doing that. So you have a contradiction. I think you have people who want to go out and do things. If they're not going to restaurants, they're still going out and walking around and trying to do things. But are both sides growing now, or there conflict between those two?
So certainly, you know, the market tanked last year, 2021, same double digit declines. Of course, we just compare back to last year. We're seeing the opposite, right? It's double digit growth. Now we're still not at pre-pandemic levels, but there's layers, right? In that story, which is your full service restaurants, which is your sit down table service places, are the ones that suffered the most, obviously.
Yeah.
QSRs were, they survived. I mean, their focus was mainly on off premise anyway. They've actually come back and recovered. So all of your fast food places, they're at pre-pandemic levels right now, which is pretty incredible if you think about it. Full service restaurants had a tear summer, fall of last year. You know, Sean, you probably drove a lot of that business.
Patios,
And, you know, it was great. People were eager to get out, and then Omi hit, and then everything went down. Yeah. But I think that demand didn't go away. And we actually have a measure that allows us to understand that level of demand, and it's through the roof. It's the highest it's ever been.
Are they still struggling to get staff? It seems to me every time I go into a restaurant, it's got limited hours. There's a very clear sign that says, hey, if you'd like to bus table some, we'd be happy to have you here.
Well, that's a huge factor.
It throttles everything down.
Yeah,
where are they? Like, where are these people?
Well, they have a lot of epiphanies, surprisingly, over this year period where, like, really, do I want to do this for the rest of my life? Either I'm front of the house, back of the house, doesn't matter. Standing on my feet, making what I am doing. And it's not that. It's not just that. It's also a lot of uncertainty, right? Because you are not sure if the restaurant you're going to go out to work for is going to shut down in 2 weeks because of government regulations. And the same thing, the owners. It's like, well, I got to plan. I got to hire. I got to spend this money. And then I got to pay their wages for another month. But they're only going to work 2 weeks because everything's going to shut down.
And on paper, you know, servers don't make that much money, right? Because a lot of it is in cash tips, meaning that their, you know, benefits are less as well. Yeah.
So it's the tough decision that I think a lot of, especially smaller business owners have had to decide, well, you know what, I'm just not going to open. I'm just going to do a takeout service. Local business will drive that. And I'm okay as long as I'm able to. I think some of them were doing better than treading water.
Yeah. If you're only doing pickup service, you probably have a third of the staff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. They're all behind the. That's right. They're all behind this counter.
Well, my wife and I used to go out for dinner pretty well every Friday night. That was, you know, date night, and maybe we might pick up something one other night of the week. And that was, of course, pre-pandemic. Now, post-pandemic, we've hardly been to any restaurants for a sit down. Now, part of that is because we bought a house and I'm a master barbecuer. So, you know, I've been taking care of that. I don't mean to brag, Mike, but, you know, I got the chicken breast down. Oh, so tender. But you know, we've just been staying home and doing that. But I suspect that we're not alone, Asad. You know, many people who were weekly diners, or you know, up to 10 times a month or something, I would say, is anybody getting back to where they were before?
Not immediately, but to your point, you know, we've been homebound. We've developed new habits. You know, there's even among younger cohorts who were driving a lot of the growth, right? Those ever elusive millennials were driving a lot of the change in the industries. But they're home because they've started to cook. You know, their repertoire's increased. They've also figured out, oh my God, I'm saving so much money doing this.
Yeah.
Right. So there's all of those, and of course that's top of mind among that cohort in particular. Having said that, though, we are still seeing outside of that blip where everything went down again January because of Omi, it all came kind of roaring back. And FSRs are actually at a really good position right now. And, you know, from the information we've seen, people are eager to go out and spend. Now, the frequency might not be as high as before, but it's not all doom and gloom on the same front.
But of course, enter inflation, right? So we've got pent up demand. The economists keep telling us we're sitting on hundreds of billions of dollars. I must have lost my billion in the couch cushion because I don't seem to have it. So, you know, how does this desire to reengage and to go out for dinners, these things that we weren't able to do for the last 2 years, how does that reconcile or conflict with now worry over inflation? I mean, a lot of our data is showing that people are worried about it, but it's not really impacting their financial situation yet. So which one of those two kind of do you see winning out over the next couple of months?
It's a great question. And that is, I think, what's top of mind for a lot of my clients right now. And, you know, if we were just to go look at numbers, you know, that size of pent up demand is slightly higher, you know, 10% more than the need for being cautious, or I'm worried about, you know, spending more, or there's economic uncertainty. But my main thing here is that it's not a clear cut story, right? I mean, there's so much nuance. And I think where the nuance is going to come in from is, again, going to that generational gap, because you have older cohorts who have more disposable income and are generally a lot more skewed higher towards dining in, right? They want that experience. And that is what everyone is craving, right? You want to connect. You want to have some of those things you used to enjoy. So I think, and I also Globe and Mail had an article over the weekend that said that we had apparently $350 billion plus in savings over the last 2 years. And again, I am not seeing much of that, but it exists somewhere. So where is that going to go? I mean, sure, they're probably smart and save it into whatever investments they might have, but it's got to be spent somewhere. Younger cohorts, even though they might be more financially strapped and probably more concerned, they're also not going to mitigate those experiences and the ability for them to hang out with their friends and socialize or go to a speakeasy or whatever it is that they want. I think it's something that we got to be mindful of, but I don't think we've reached the tipping point where everyone's going to be like, oh, I'm not spending anymore.
Yeah, I see it very volatile and sentiment sort of surpassing fundamentals right now. And we'll see which catches up to which, right? I mean, our fundamentals don't look good in terms of how people feel about their finances, but sentiment has been improving a little bit the last couple months. And I think it's it's summer, there's no restrictions. And I think you're right. I think there's a group at the top who have money and are going, I wasn't able to spend it. I'm going to get something out of it. And then I think there's a group of younger, but not poorer at the bottom who are looking at the long-term and going, the long-term doesn't look great, so I'm going to go enjoy myself today.
Yeah.
Which isn't the best way to build a country, but it's probably a good way to make restaurants tick. I'm interested in anything you've seen on diversity through food. I'll full disclosure, my name is Mike College. grew up in a house where, you know, Yorkshire pudding was one and roast beef and fish and chips, and the diversity night was pizza. Southern Ontario, and you know, and that obviously changes as you go to university. And I look at my oldest daughter now, who's in Toronto, and, you know, two generations from her grandfather is Indian food one night, Sri Lankan food another, Thai food another. First of all, bigger cities, wealth of options. But even in smaller cities, that's become more and more an option. I'm just wondering what your thoughts on those trends. And are we as diverse in our food as we are becoming in our population?
So, you know, I think one of those changes of passing the baton between older and younger generations is reflective of that change of what we prefer and what's out there. So, you know, obviously new Canadians generally tend to be younger, and that's also going to make sense in terms of their experiences, their palates, their values are having an influence. And I think it's a two-way street. You know, you have demand for them, whether you have an entire aisle in the grocery store or an entire grocery store dedicated to them versus the restaurants. But then you have local Canadians who are trying them out, either because they're that generation, because they want the same experiences, or others who just want to try them. So, you know, I think poutine and Jamaican patties generally can be synonymous to what we've been eating as Canadians forever, right?
What a great food truck, actually. Yeah.
Poutines and patties.
Smack it up, right, with the cocoa bread. Make a sandwich, yeah. Stuff it with some poutine. Oh, yes. Okay, I'm going to get really hungry.
All right, we got a new job. Yeah. sorry, go on.
No, but it's an evolution, and I think it's reflected with the dynamic. And for me, it's a big deal because I'm in that, like, my meal plans at home are, like, I will never have the same thing to my detriment. but it's because I just like that variety. I'm seeing that evolution definitely in the food service landscape as well. So multicultural cuisine is around a $12 billion industry in Canada. That's just in food service alone. Yeah. And you look at the chains that have been opening here, right? We're talking about Thai places, local ones that have evolved. So, you know, I'm talking Toronto specific now, Pai, Sukhothai, like all of these that evolved. Then you've got Eat BKK, that's a fairly new chain, but it's been growing. Again, urban centers, you have a Vancouver chain, Japanese one, Miku, that opened, which is high end. And then you've got the Toroni Empire on the same kind of level. But they're all authentic. That's the main thing. I mean, it's a matter of delivering there. And you even have foreign chains that are coming in, whether you're talking about Jollibee's, which is, you know, Filipino fried chicken. You're talking about a whole slew of mainland Chinese, Hong Kong, Korean fried chicken chains, especially if you get out of the downtown core and the peripheral burbs. Like, it's a whole different world out there, and the variety is just incredible.
Which is fantastic because it really does make us a great place to attract talented new immigrants, because you feel more welcome where you see yourself, right? Yeah. Where you see those options initially, right? And so to come into a country and see things that are common from a cultural standpoint, a food standpoint, it's a great sign, I think. Sorry, Sean, you're going to say something.
Well, I was just going to say, as I reflect on all this, Asad, I'm not even sure I could do your job. I'd be 400 pounds talking about food all day. It just makes me so hungry. I just want to go and eat it all. Which I guess diverse or ethnic food, what's the proper terminology for, is it just diverse food or
it's an interesting evolution of a question, but I mean multicultural food, that could be it. I mean, ethnic is the usual way to go, but you know, there's, it's a lot more than that.
I've never seen a Yorkshire pudding shop. Just saying.
There's still tons of meat pies here.
Yes.
There's Australian ones and British ones.
And in the Kitchener Market, there's a meat pie stand, Mike. And, you can come down and visit sometime. We'll get you some meat pies. Okay. I was going to say, which multicultural food are Canadians most gaga for? Is it like Thai? My vote would be Thai, but maybe I'm not in the majority there.
No, so in general it's Asian, right? Yeah. And then within Asian it depends on what, like, you've got East and the South, and East really dominates, and it's just the diversity in that, right? So you've got the Japanese ramen, and then the evolution of the Rizkayas, which are, you know, they're pubs just in Markham alone, and the regional variety of Chinese food there is just incredible. So you still have Mandarin. even in a pandemic, they managed to survive, and that demand's still going to be there.
I was thinking to myself, do people still go to the Mandarin with all of these things that are available to them?
There's going to be a core group, right? Yeah. And then it's also synonymous with a Canadian brand. But it's getting harder to compete, I think, in that space.
How do you differentiate between a fad and a trend in the food service landscape? You know, and I guess it can be food, like foods themselves or diets or any number of things. But how does something have to persist for so long for it to become a trend? Or can you spot early on what's going to stick and what isn't?
It's a great question. Really, really hard to differentiate. One of the key things we use, obviously, is our data and the fact that it is actually trended behavioral data. So it's not based on a single point. It's something that we've tried to look at. So if we're talking any type of behavior change, we try and validate it with any of the points that we've seen over time. So, for example, conscious consumption is a term we've been using for a while. And, you know, if Kathy Parada works with me, is kind of like the guru when it comes to a lot of the trends that we see around food and beverages. And the evolution of it is that, you know, we're a lot more educated than we have been, especially younger generations. They're a lot more mindful of what's happening, not just for our bodies, but pretty much the environment. So, you know, from there, you have offshoots about, well, let's say plant-based foods. What's the origins for that? How big is it? Is it really beneficial? Is it processed? Well, it started from the point that health and wellness when it comes to food and beverages isn't just about nutrition, right? That's still a biggest component of it. But then there's layers to it, which is that what's the end benefit for me? You know, are there things that I want to consume because it's going to improve my hair or my eyesight or my skin? And then finally, it's a matter of, well, what's the social and environmental impact it's going to have? Because a lot of the younger consumers, those kind of secondary, tertiary drivers is really what's top of mind for them. And that is really where we get into the growth of, say, something like the plant-based movement. You know, and if you look at vegans, vegetarians, they make up 6-7% of the population. You know, we used to call them flexitarians, and now Kathy keeps on calling them lessitarians because she likes to change and be creative all the time. And it's basically people who like to eat meat less. And that's a sizable portion of the population now, 28-35%. And really? They're doing it not just because of their personal health, but because of maybe all the methane that's going to get out there and, you know, destroy, have all the carbon dioxide.
They're not in Russell, Mike.
Sorry, I'm a little shocked. 30% of the population would like to eat less meat. Is that what you're saying? Or
that's right. Between anywhere between 28-35%.
They're certainly not in Russell. But that's fascinating. And I think this isn't so much a question, but your thoughts on maybe a lesson learned, because we're seeing in other areas, it's hard to get people to consider the climate, right? It's hard in their actions today. They say they will, but then they don't, right? In purchases and day to day. It seems the path in food, and if I'm listening to you correctly, is it didn't start with what's good for the environment, good for others. It started with what's good for me, health, wellness, and personal. And then it's morphed into, what's good for me is also good for the environment. Where most of the climate change argument today is, you better do something that's good for the whole and the environment, or else it's going to be a real personal problem for you later. We've put the horse after the cart, it seems, when it looks like the food sector, not by design necessarily, but because of personal health concerns, did it the other way around.
Yeah, It's certainly, I mean, at the end of the day, we care about what we do personally in reality more than the external exogenous factors. But I think it's all tied together. And the main thing that I see is that, you know, people just are a lot more mindful, especially younger generations, shockingly enough. I know there's lots of different kind of views on generational dynamics, but they're also bombarded with information all the time. I mean, it was just the internet before, now on social media, and it's kind of reinforced, right? I mean, if we're talking about those types of narratives or echo chambers, it's also existent there. And that's having an influence, right?
I gotta tell you, I'm still shocked at the 30% who are low on the meat scale. I consider myself fairly in tune with the world, but I can tell you, I can tell you the vast majority of the people I hang around with are carnivores.
I can smell your ribs smoking right now out back. Like,
so it just seems, yeah, okay.
So I don't know if this is, you know, me changing my behavior based on what I'm reading. So I love meat. Like if you give me a good steak, really well marbled, you know, I don't need anything more than salt and pepper, you know, and it has to be sourced from a good farm. Mm-hmm. It makes a difference. But I know my stomach, and I know the difference it makes when I try and add up more fiber in my diet throughout the week.
Yeah.
And thankfully, my wife is a lot more functional versus my emotional eating. So that helps. But I'm doing that behavior. You know, I'm consciously having, it's not just a meatless Monday thing. It's a couple of days a week.
Yeah. You mentioned a good farm. Is the organic still a growing part of the sector?
Yeah, organic's like table stakes in some ways, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so...
why am I still paying more for it?
Well, still, unfortunately, it's only 30% or maybe less. but yeah, I mean, it's going to be, unless it's mass, hard to get, but it's still important. And like I said, there's lots of layers of what people seek, but that's one of the table stakes needs when it comes to... nutritional facts or sourcing or where it's from.
So there's sort of four things that I know when I'm shopping with my wife, she's looking for. Organic is obviously important to her. Local, eating local. Waste and packaging. Now, the silly thing is a lot of times the organic stuff comes in copious amounts of packaging. So I feel like that kind of negates what you're trying to go after. And then the other is that I've completely forgotten what the other one is, because I was thinking about Mike's ribs. Are there any kind of going on the upswing and then going on the downswing? Oh, animal health. That's the fourth one. So just treatment of animals and are all of those becoming increasingly important, or have some peaked and they're starting to decline a bit?
No, I think so. Organic points are steady. For sure. And it's, again, one of the more sizable points. The points around, animal health, sustainability, sourcing are continuing to rise, right? And it's derived from that kind of tertiary layer where it's just becoming more and more important. The younger consumers are driving a lot of that shift and growth. And I think that's something that we're going to continue to see. Things like cholesterol, like the basic stuff, calories, all of that still exists. That's still top. But these are the smaller details that continue to grow over time.
So we're in a constant shift is what I'm hearing.
Right now, absolutely. I mean, I think whatever we're seeing with the pandemic has accelerated some of them, depending on, you know, the channel or what it is. But I think when you it's that generational shift, right? That passing of the baton of this is what I like, this is what my preferences are, or versus the younger generation. We've done analysis on parents. And again, there's a term that Kathy coined called young educated millennial parents. Yaps, for sure. Yeah, I didn't make that up, but it sticks. Yep. Right? And our clients like it. So
yeah, I like it.
So their behaviors are very different from previous generation parents. If you're talking to parents, you can't talk to them in the same language. Their behaviors are reflecting what their generation wants. I didn't myself. I'm not a millennial. I'm a Gen Xer. But when I had my kid, I bought more organic products than I've ever done in my entire life. I stopped that now, and she can eat off the floor, which is totally fine. But it's just, you know, it's that psyche that drives it. And also just, again, that awareness that you think it's better for you. It's good for you. We're trying to, so we're watching this documentary last night on I think it's called History 101 on Netflix, and it was about plastics. And it's just scary, like, when you look at this and you're like, okay, we got to make better efforts to reduce our usage of plastics as well. So I think there's a lot of influence right now for that.
So based on what you know, how long have you been digging in the food space? Now,
At least the last decade.
Last decade. So, Sean and I are going to pool all of our saved billions, and we want you to leave Ipsos. Well, we don't want you to leave Ipsos, but it theoretically, start a food business. If the goal is to make as much money as you can for us, what is that food business? Restaurant, food sector, etc. If the goal is for Assad to have as much fun and enjoy himself as possible, what's that business? So two different businesses based on, and you're playing with Sean and I's money here.
Yeah. So. No risk to you.
So then I can like, you can go all the way because you're going to lose it straight away because of that.
Well, in the second scenario, let's say we can afford to lose the money. But the first scenario,
it's no quicker than the roulette wheel.
what's our food business if we want to make money?
So there's, let me play back. So I understand. One is where's
the biggest growth opportunity. And one is, you personally, what would be the funnest, most entertaining space to be?
Oh, God, that's a tough one.
You didn't think it was going to be easy coming on here, did you?
There is immediately right now. People go out to eat because they want to treat themselves, right?
Okay.
First and foremost, especially if you're compared to preparing in house, there's the convenience stuff and all that. You know, if I wanted to be looking at the little signals, right, any kind of health and wellness space might be unique, right? Whether you're talking about fresh juices, anything around that area. But that's not where the immediate opportunity is. Right now, it's all about fried chicken sandwiches.
Well,
so you open up any place that has an offering for a fried chicken sandwich, you will be okay.
Really?
I mean, Pizza had fried chicken sandwiches, for God's sake. Right? You know, it's good, but it's just out of their wheelhouse.
Yeah.
So that tells you how much demand there is. And especially around the pandemic, it was portable. You had independents on a grassroots movement having Nashville hot chicken. And it just took off, right? And then Popeyes had theirs, which blew up the internet.
So the Big Crunch is no longer the only game in town from KFC.
Oh, that's not even their main offering on that front either.
Oh, really? Oh, geez.
They've got their new offering too.
You're out of date. But so if it's just for you, for the love of food, what business would you start?
For me, cafes are always fun, right? Like it's a certain hour thing, you know, the environment, the music, the lighting, all of that. It's just relaxed. So that would be a good gig. You know, coffee's been a bit of a challenge.
The fried chicken cafe.
Ooh, there you go.
Good idea.
My God, perfect combo. I'll have to see what. Okay, how many occasions have both of them? Because it's a huge opportunity.
We're asking the right person.
Sean, do you got anything else you would want to steal from Assad while we start up our food business?
Any other intel? No, that was terrific. I learned a lot. And my stomach is rumbling now.
Any final thoughts on future of food that you want to share with us? Or have we stole all of your brain today?
No. Great questions. You know, I think there's obviously an apprehension, right? The industry, you know, there's been two sides. Grocery, booming. Food service, not so much. So I think that balance and dynamic is going to continue to kind of fight itself. But, you know, I'm quite optimistic for the food service sector. I think they're going to do well. I think there's still challenges and a lot of uncertainty looming. But I think there's a lot of changes that have taken place that I think both sectors have to be very mindful of and how that plays out.
And it makes sense. As important as food is to us on a personal level and as much as it's a necessity for everyone, it's not immune from the market either, right? And there is generally a lot of uncertainty. Our data shows that, you know, there's probably as much or more uncertainty than there was when the start of the pandemic. It's different. It's morphed differently, but it's a very volatile space right now, and a very challenging space for everybody.
I'm just hoping for my hope and my prayer is that Canadians go and they support the restaurants that they like, you know, on a regular basis, so that, you know, when they want to go and dine in a restaurant for a special occasion, they're still there.
Yeah, 100%. You know, and I think it's those mom and pop places that have been there around. I mean, there's a communal factor to all of this that certainly people are playing out, but it's tough, right? And, you know, just around our offices here, there used to be a bunch of small independent places that we used to go regularly to. A lot of them have shut down. I mean, we're around Yorkville, so it doesn't help with the real estate prices there. But, you know, it's been a struggle. It's been such a struggle. And I think the industry, the food service industry, needs some light at the end of the tunnel now.
Well, thank you very much, Asad. Maybe we'll get you back someday just to talk about beverages, because we focus mostly on food.
Oh, yeah.
And you want to ask an alcohol question, Sean, before we go?
Oh, jeez. Well, I have so many. I'll save them for that's a whole other podcast.
Let's come back at some point.
What share do I have of the Canadian market?
We'll run those numbers for a future podcast, Sean. Yeah,
sounds good.
I think that's an
excellent. I'd love to come back. Thank you, guys. It was lovely.
Yeah, I do think because I initially thought we would get to food and the drink portion of it, and all we've done is joke about drinking, and it's a serious matter. So, yeah, let's have you back to talk about that.
We'll bring our alcohol experts on board as well. So
perfect.
All right. Excellent. Well, thank you, Asad. And thank you, Sean. It's almost dinner time somewhere, I'm sure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Educated Conjecture. Follow us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts for another episode of Public Opinion and Informed Insights. If you have a topic you'd like to see covered on an upcoming episode, please send us an email at publicaffairs@ipsos.com. That's publicaffairs@ipsos.com.